What's up, everybody? It is Keith with the Scream Team, with me as always, Chris Lowry and Cole Miller, and we're still in the Bad Movies That We Love series, and we're back around to Cole's second pick in the series of Bad Movies That We Love, and we're going, unsurprisingly, to a Bond movie. Not that Bond movies are bad, it's just Cole's pick, and this is not a great surprise that this is the second Bond film that he has picked. Well,
third. This is
right.
Third
I know
one.
We've done others. I'm saying your third one you've picked. Yeah. So yeah, we're going to 1974, The Man with the Golden Gun, a movie that features Roger Moore as James Bond, the second of the seven James Bond movies that he would do, the ninth installment of the James Bond series, directed by Guy Hamilton, runtime of 2 hours and 5 minutes, had a Rotten Tomato score of 42-55. And we'll dive into that. It has a budget of $7 million. It earned $20 million total, and it ended up being the lowest grossing Bond movie to date. And it almost ended the series, apparently, with some behind the scenes complications that were worked through and delayed production on the next. But anyway, we'll get into that as we get into the trivia towards the end of the podcast. But yeah, so this is the, like I said, the ninth installment of James Bond, the second of Roger Moore's career as James Bond. Like I said, he ended up going on to do seven total. And just like I have with all the others we'll talk about when we talk about bad movies that we love, Cole, outside of this being the James Bond series, and I mean, that's pretty self-explanatory, what about this movie is your love for it? Why is this the one that you went with?
Yeah, it's fascinating because it's a simple answer for me, and it's Scaramanga. Like, that is the ultimate Bond villain. And we've obviously seen actors recently, tremendous actors. We've talked about it in Skyfall. All of those different people who are playing Bond villains have been outstanding, right? But something about Francisco Scaramanga and being played by Christopher Lee, who puts in one of the greatest Bond villain performances, I think, of any of the Bond movies. And Crush. I think that because of a story and because of a character and because of all these different really great actors, they were really just let down by a bad script. And that's really what this movie boils down to as far as not working, is that it just wasn't very well written. And that's kind of a shame because, again, this is the first kind of Bond movie that got negative reviews, didn't make a ton of money. You know, they, like you were saying, Keith, they genuinely thought the series was going to be over, and they still tripled their budget, right? Like, so the interesting thing about this one, and the reason I love this one so much, is I think that for all of the flaws of the movie, it's one of the most boiled down badass type Bond movies, right? Because usually there's one guy who's trying to take over the world and destroy it, but this is another assassin who is at the top of his game, who has an ego through the roof, and he's trying to control solar energy, right? And sell it to the highest bidder. Like, all of that is way more stripped down than a lot of the other Bond villain plots, especially up to this point, right? They were massive, massive plots. Like, oh yeah, we're gonna blow up planet Earth unless we get $10 billion. This was just some dude who thought he was that guy, right? And he needed to prove it to himself. And he also had, you know, he was trying to sell off solar energy and all that sort of stuff. Like, of course, there was that plot to it. But at the end of the day, it was a very kind of stripped-down Bond movie where the only person that Bond really kills in the whole movie is Scaramanga, right? Like, it was such a different take on the movie. And yes, it didn't necessarily work, but a lot of the movies in this series that don't necessarily work, it's when they're trying something different. And I respect that, but I also just really love The Man with the Golden Gun. Like, that's just a badass villain, right? And this movie, again, we'll talk about it, the things that don't work about it, but it's stylish. It's a very good travel movie, and you get one of the best Bond villains that I think there is of the series. So, I mean, that for me is why I love this one. I do think that Roger Moore, this is kind of his weakest, I would say, as far as like not really knowing what he's supposed to be doing with Bond, even though he's like got that cool, charming allure to him. He was able to like cut it loose a lot more in Live and Let Die, and then the ones after that do the things that he was good at. And it felt like in this one, they were still trying to figure out what that was. And I think that probably has a lot of the reason. But, I mean, you know, Roger Moore was a damn good Bond, and this is a good Bond movie. So I wanted to do it for a lot of reasons. I love it because of the characters. But it also is an interesting one because, again, like you were saying, Keith, it's the one that was the first one to do bad and just kind of be bad.
Mm-hmm. Which is weird because I think it's especially at that time, I just feel like people weren't as critical as we are today. And I know it's 74 and we're not talking about that far long ago. We're also not talking about like a recent movie either, but it just seems as if people were just going to be like, oh, it's James Bond, so we're just going to like it. We're just going to go with it. And so I think that it speaks to, like you're talking about, Cole, kind of the flaws of it. And throughout the course of watching this, is actually my first time to watch it. There were just, it just seemed like it stopped itself. Like there'd be some momentum, and then it would come to a screeching halt, or like the plot really wasn't lining up. And you know, I think 2 hours and 5 minutes is a little lengthy for not a lot of, I mean, at that point, you know, we're at this point, we're in the 9th movie of the series. And so it's like, we're not going to get any more character development, so what are we doing with the 2-hour and 5-minute movie?
Why is it so hefty,
like,
right? The problem is it almost needed to be longer to give you more about what was actually going on, right? There was just too many things going on, and it wasn't clean.
Correct.
And, like, for it to feel long and also you not get enough information, it's one of those, like, that's one of the tragic flaws of movies, right?
Right, correct. Yeah, it's like if it's going to be long, let it be informative, or like let it build on something. And I know we'll continue to get several more Bonds after this, so it's not like this is the
and
last
some really
of the
good
season.
Ones.
We just got left
with
the clip,
right
cliffhanger.
After this.
Yeah. Right, yeah, yeah, exactly. So it did build, it almost self-sabotaged. And it was it was hokey at parts too, where it's just like it seemed like a Three Stooges skit sometimes, where it could have been more serious with the action parts of it.
Campy.
But it's also 1974, right? Yeah, like, you know, when we get J.W. Pepper, like all of his scenes, he's just like really playing up the Southern, the sheriff, or the deputy that he's playing. And so, you know, the insertion of his character didn't really add a lot of substance to it. But that's okay. I mean, again, like, it's like you're talking about, like the writing kind of fell flat. And so then we have this character coming in and it's like, oh, is he going to be a part of MI6 or what is this guy doing? But he just so happened to be vacationing and that was the case. But
yeah, and he was in,
anyway, you
know, I don't
know
the last time you watched Live and Let Die, but he was in it. Like he had a short. So when Bond was in,
like a quick
was in New Orleans, he had like was running away. They basically, J.W. Pepper was like the sheriff that was trying to take down Bond until he realized he was an agent. And it worked really well, I would say, in Live and Let Die. So I think they were just trying to go back to the well. And it just didn't work this time as well. Because, I mean, I think that it is very interesting to see what British people thought about Americans. I thought that was hilarious. And like how we act and stuff, that kind of killed me a little bit. But all in all, I'm with you. He didn't really fit in this one very well.
It's actually very funny.
It was just downright offensive sometimes.
Oh no. Yeah. Very, very, very much so. He said, if you get your pointy hands out of those pajamas, maybe you could row or something like that. And just like, whoa, relax.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, relax, guy. What are you so upset?
Yeah.
What are you so upset about? Like, that's not even, but anyway, it was an interesting dynamic, I would say, just to have all those movies. Did it feel like, Chris, you know, watching this, was this your first time watching this, Chris? Let me ask you that first.
Yeah, this is my first time watching this one, yeah.
Same. Did it feel like it was trying to do too much? I don't want to say too many moving parts, but maybe too many moving parts, and we're trying to connect all those things and then maybe get a call back to some stuff, and it was just like, it was maybe trying to just execute on a few too many things?
I think so. Yeah, that's what, you know, we've been getting, and I totally agree on that point. There is just, like, a lot going on. It's weird because, like, the plot, like, as far as, like, where he's going and why is, for the most part, easy enough to... Okay, where he's going and, like, seeing it is easy enough to follow, but, like, the why is what's kind of confused. Like, there's just so much going on. Like, why, you know, do we need this product? Does it end up being, like, the scene at the school, right, the karate school, does it end up being kind of fun and cool and, you know, kind of different for a Bond movie? Sure, of course. Like, I enjoy that scene. It's fun. But you also step back and have to ask, like, why? Like, this is like, what, like a 15-minute scene, and you're just like, we don't really get too much out of him. Obviously, what happened before, you know, they caught him, they're going to kill him, and they take him there instead to let somebody else kill him. but it's just like, what a weird scene to insert at that point in the movie when, like, we're supposed to be getting, like, the peak, you know, spy and espionage parts of, like, we could have used that time to really get some more insight as to, like you said, Cole, what's really going on, what his plan really is, like, why he's selling off the solar energy, just learning about that a bit more. Because it's also, like, there's, like, a huge gap in the movie where Scaramanga is just, like, not in it, you know what I mean? Like, he kind of shows up and, like, has his most fun, like, at the end, and then, you know, he dies a couple minutes after. So it does, like, that is just an example of just too many other things outside of, like, the central plot that are kind of going on that kind of just, you know, beef it up and kind of weigh it down and pull you away from what's happening. And again, I think there's always room to have, you know, maybe some of these, I don't want to necessarily call them subplots, but some of these, like, smaller moments that, you know, maybe do take them out of the story for more specific reasons in film. But this one just has, like, a lot of, so, like, it has, like, a lot of characters who are kind of saying things that are either important or not important that you're gonna have to keep up with and remember who they are when you're seeing them. So it really is just kind of filled to the brim. It's like just way too much, you know, is happening that you need to, you know, keep tabs on to a degree, because it is easy to kind of, like, lose sight on some people and kind of, I don't think, like, you could be full-on confused and not, you know what's happening. It's easy to kind of lose tabs on people that exit the movie for a decent chunk of time, and they come back in, and you have to, like, reacclimate yourself with why they're in the story and, you know, what they're serving and how they're going to get you to the next important part of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was so... Cole, I do agree wholeheartedly. I was really into Scaramanga and Christopher Lee's. That's the kind of villain I wish would reoccur. I wish he didn't die and we would have him maybe pop up. Maybe not in the next one.
Such a shame that he got a bad one. You know what I mean? Because like everything about that character is so fucking good. And I've got a film concept I'm going to run by y'all at the end, but it's just, it is such a shame because, like, Christopher Lee was so good in this.
So good.
Like, and kind of out-acted everybody, and it just was, it really is a shame.
It is. I was really, with what he did, it was like, let's get him, and I know we'd already, you know, like, let him be the head of Spectre or something where he survives at the end. We think he dies, he survives at the end, and then he ends up being the spearhead to a criminal underworld. But anyway, we don't get that. But it seemed a little bit to me like, he's the most expensive assassin in the world, and so we've got that aspect. But he also wants,
love it, great plot point,
right? Perfect. I didn't like the whole solar power aspect. I just wanted him to be like the world's greatest assassin, most expensive assassin, and then
he just wanted to prove himself to Bond, right?
Correct.
And that's right. The movie, or sorry, rather the book was a lot more of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that I like the plot. Like, I like the solar energy plot, and I think that of the time period, it's very unique and stuff like that. But you almost, because of the way that they talk about it, it's like they don't dumb it down enough to where you actually have to, like, legitimately understand solar energy, and how it works and the market and, like, why that would be important and all this sort of stuff to understand that part of the plot. But they don't talk about it very much. And it's like, okay, well, you know, there aren't a lot of people just casually watching a Bond movie that want to understand how, you know, solar energy works, right? And especially 1974,
right? Yeah, exactly. And then we have Nick Knack too, who is like, does he have his own plans, and is he trying to be the head of the organization too? So I just feel like on the criminal aspect of it, there was just a little bit too much going on, and I really felt like there wasn't some solid footing as far as like what was actually trying to be accomplished outside of just wanting to be toe-to-toe with Bond. And I mean, I know that it did take a while for Bond and Scaramanga to really step toe-to-toe. We did have some scenes where they were kind of dancing around it towards each other. And, you know, in particular where the head of the I think it was like the missing solar expert was assassinated, where we thought it was Bond getting assassinated because we were thinking that Anders had sold him a bad, like stuff like that. I was like, okay, I'm with it. There were some good, were some good twists in it. It's like, oh, okay, so because we know he didn't miss Bond because he doesn't miss, and so it was like we find out that he's actually going for the solar expert. So there's just a lot of good stuff going, and it just didn't it didn't really pan out. But anyway, we talk about Bond villains all the time, even in movies where Bond villains aren't in them. We're just talking about villains in general. Outside of the Scaramanga, do we feel like it was trying to do too much with Nick Knack? And then we have, you know, we have Scaramanga, he ends up killing Hayfat that he killed as well.
Hayfat.
That's right, Hayfat in the mausoleum. Another gimmick. But anyway, so it is, you know, look, I mean, as far from an entertainment standpoint, though, I do like Roger Moore. I know a lot of people have ranked, and I think, Cole, you even put Roger Moore up as far as one of your favorite Bonds when we did talk about that a little bit. But, you know, him playing, and I think it really felt like he was getting his footing when it comes to this. I know this is the second of seven, but he was just trying to figure out how he wanted to play Bond. Chris, you know, talk about Roger Moore and this being your first time watching it. Did it feel like an actor trying to figure out Bond, where Bond is still kind of trying to figure out who he is as well, as far as a 00 goes?
I think so, yeah. You can definitely tell that he is still trying to find the footing and exactly how he wants to play. There are a couple of moments where he feels, he almost feels like sillier than what we see in a lot of other Bond movies. Like, he has moments where he's like a bit more jokey. And that's fine. Now, some of the Bond movies do have moments where he's kind of funny. Maybe comedic is like too strong of a way to describe, but you know, he does have moments like, like it's close to like the films will, or the movies will sometimes present him with situations where you can't help but to almost be like, you know, a funny person engaging with some of that stuff. You know, like for instance, in No Time to Die, there are a couple moments that are, you know, a little bit more zany that certainly feel like callbacks to some of the earlier Bonds. And then I think a lot of that does kind of, you know, build off of what he was trying to do here. But you can definitely tell that this is like, how serious do I want to go? You know, how cocky do I want to make him? Do I want him to lean into, you know, quipping isn't necessarily what I would say because it wasn't necessarily that. But it's like, do I want to lean too heavy into, you know, trying to get a joke off sometimes? Like, do I want to just keep him as being like silent and straightforward and direct, and, you know, almost kind of mean? And it's just like, again, from seeing the other movies that he's done, see how Bond has portrayed in a lot of the other, you know, different iterations, you can definitely tell that like this one, especially in this movie, is, you know, the one that kind of stands out as, you could see that they're trying stuff with Bond. And sometimes, you know, like maybe it's just for the sake of this movie, but some of it does end up strangely working. Again, I think it may just be for the case of the movie that it's happening in. So it's just like, you know, you can kind of let it slide because you're just like, this movie is kind of all over the place and zany. So if he's going to be a little sillier here, then, you know, it's fine. You know, for instance, early on when he gets done beating up all the guys in the room with the dancer, and she's like, I've lost my charm, and he like does a double take, and he's like,
doesn't look
not
like
from where I'm standing.
Yeah.
And it's like, he's like slow-mo creeping away. And like, that one is just like, in the context of the scene and the film that it's in, it's, you know, it's pretty fun. Like, it's serviceable. It's an enjoyable part of the movie. When you think about like, that's like a Bond thing, you're just like, So yeah, he was definitely, and maybe it wasn't even just, you know, Roger Moore specifically. Maybe it's like, you know, the writing was like that because as they were creating this film, they were trying to think of where they wanted to take him going forward, if they wanted to change anything in general. But just so much of this reads as, what do we kind of do with this guy here? Do we need to maybe tweak him a little bit? Do we need to maybe inject some life? Do we need to try to change something? And it is, you know, it's very obvious. Again, it didn't entirely take me out or ruin it for me because I was just so settled into the movie that I'm watching. But it's impossible to not notice. Even compared to, and I know this is like a very different iteration, even compared to like the Daniel Craig Bonds. And I know like sometimes people didn't like just how serious and straightforward those got to be.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are people who say like that's what Bond is more like. And so it's a standout silly guy. It is.
No, it's tough.
It's really hard to make, especially making nine of them, you know. And I'm with y'all, like it. When you look at any of the Bond actors, they all try to do their own thing. And because you can't like any of the ones that have tried to replicate somebody else, it just didn't work for. And he was never going to be Connery, right? Like that just wasn't his skill set. He was never going to be able to be like George Lazenby, but could he be his own sort of Bond character? And I think that once you get past this one, you get to The Spy Who Loved Me and you get to some of the other ones, he's really figured it out, what it is that he's good at, what he is. And he just has a charm to him that, you know, Roger Moore of all of them just kind of has more than the others, right? Like, he just has that kind of like schwarmy charm that you just don't really get from guys like Daniel Craig, who obviously is charming as fuck, but in a very different way.
Right.
What, so Cole, and obviously you have a lot of Bond history. When it, how long with the movies have we gotten, like those, like you're talking, like Chris is talking about, like those dropping the, basically I call them Arnold one-liners, because essentially he cornered the market on dropping those one line, like, my, don't bother my friend, he's dead tired, like, you know, Bond dropped a bunch of those liners. And it, had it already kind of been established, or was it trying to kind of give him another dimension in kind of his character?
Yeah, that was already kind of a Bond thing. Yeah, it kind of was. And then Connery did quite a few of them. There's, you know, one where he threw a heater into a bathtub with somebody and it electrocuted him, and he just goes shocking, you know, like, yeah. those are just the things that Bond has just done. And pretty much all of them continue to do that, where you just pull off those one-liners. I think Roger Moore had, they packed his with more,
yeah,
which is funny to say because his last name is Moore, but of course, like, they just kind of put a lot of them in instead of like timed, like the Daniel Craig ones are timed perfectly, and there's only usually about two or three a movie, which are always like really good, and the Pierce Brosnan ones do a good job of that too. But yeah, Roger Moore's, they're just like, one-liner here, cool, one-liner here, cool, let's do it.
Yeah, it's like they're just placed in weird spots. Like, I don't want to make it seem like I was saying, like, Bond shouldn't have those one-liners, because, like you're saying, he's always had them. But I guess I'm like, this, like, some of the moments that they happen just felt, like, too forced. Like, they were trying too hard to, like, make this extremely well-known thing. As, like you're saying, he already does. It's like, people knows that he kind of gets these one-liners off, and it's, like, appropriate isn't the right word, because it's hard to describe that as like an appropriate time to, you know, say that, but he gets them off in moments that fit the character and that are funny and allow him to be like witty. And in this, it just seemed like something would happen, like they had no choice but like, let's make him comment on this, like right as it gets done happening. And it's just like, just didn't feel like a moment where it was necessary for him to do it. Again, even for the ones that I thought landed, that I thought were funny, it's just like, this just doesn't feel like a moment where, and I know you said we can't compare him to other Bond actors because everyone does their own thing, but it's just like, this doesn't feel like a moment where, you know, Pierce Brosnan would have tried to, you know, get a line like that off or anything like that.
And I think he gets better at timing them, or they all as a unit do.
Yes.
This is just it's a strange one. Like, it's, if, like, let's say later in the, like, if this was the fifth one he was in, I think it would have worked significantly better, because he probably could have gone off script and did the things that make him Bond, right? But being it his second one after the first one was so successful, and you're early in the Bond, you know, as much as nine movies is early, but you're early kind of in the cycle of things, and the writing all of a sudden is bad. Like, you know, Daniel Craig could have made it work because he's a fantastic actor, right? Like, he probably could have taken, in fact, Quantum of Solace is a pretty bad script, but they make it work more so than this one, I would say. But like, it still works, right?
And
I think that's kind of my thought, is that I think, like, you know, later in his career he probably could have pulled it off better, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. And of course, as movies evolve and as we get more modern, you know, we have scripts that evolve and actors are better and you know, things just more sharp and more crisp, and we learn from past movies and experiences. And so it is very difficult. And that's why I really give actors a lot of credit modern movies. But when it comes to like more CGI or better writing or all the things that we know and love today, to still pull off a good movie whenever people are like legitimately having to stare at, you know, a head on a stick or something like that. I know movies do that now, but there's, you know, there's some movies set in earlier times. It's just like, how in the world did this particular actor like driving on it with the screen, clearly a screen behind him, like we're talking about North by Northwest, and having that, you know, those particular scenes, you know, whenever he's driving, look, you know, he's really, I mean, he was acting his ass off in those scenes where he's driving, stuff like that. I really have some newfound respect for, because it's just like, it's so hard to pull that off and make it believable. But things that we talk about a lot when it comes to the Bond movies.
Yeah, a lot of good stuff like that. Yeah. Explosions, all that sort of stuff. They did a really good job. A lot of the practical stuff. I mean, of course, that's a lot of money to
correct.
Spend on
$7 million in 74. Yep.
You can do cool shit.
It was a ton. And yeah. Just as important, honestly, just
that's
as
Blue
important
Blue Streak
as...
money. I still can't stop
that's
thinking
crazy.
About that, dude.
Yeah, $60 million.
Crazy. Just as important as the Bond villain is, the Bond lady is almost as important, if not more so, truly. And so we have two really kind of lead ladies. I don't know, honestly. Like, I know we have Andrea Anders as in there, but also Goodnight was really good too. I thought that she was just going to kind of be another insertion as far as maybe some comedic relief goes, but she ended up being a very pivotal point in there. Mm-hmm. Cole, talking from a female lead perspective and just having a Bond girl, or in this particular case Bond girls, how do you like these in regards to just the Bond series in general? How well do you think, in particular Anders, how do you think she did?
Man, Maude Adams to me is like a top five for, like, I just, in that, she was the Francisco Scaramanga mistress. She is just, like, there was just magic whenever
electric,
she was on
right?
screen. And I thought that, like, she just had that, she had that, everything, if you were to make a Bond girl in a lab, she would be the person you made. And she actually got kind of a small role in this one, and they actually... Later on in Octopussy, they actually bring her back as a Bond girl, a totally different character. they used to do that. There's actually like quite a few like repeat characters in the Bond series that are just the same fucking actor. But they like bring her back. But anyways, she in this was outstanding. And the Goodnight, and I can never remember that actress's name, and I hate that I can't because she is so good. And she has like... Even this, you know, of course, a lot of those
Brit,
at that time
Brit
period.
Brit Eklund.
That's it. Yes. Back in this time, a lot of it was not particularly, you know, they're not exactly like women empowerment characters, right? Like, that's just not how the characters were portrayed in the early 70s, and especially in Bond movies. But mm-hmm. she, specifically her... has a very kind of modern feel to her as a Bond girl. Not necessarily the character, not necessarily the way it was played, but the way that the actress kind of carried herself throughout the movie. And I think that mm-hmm. that's one of those things that I liked most about this one, was that Goodnight was just like this kind of badass, you know, like she had, again, we're talking about a time period, so it's just a time period of how women in movies were treated. But she did, as an actress, have this kind of thing to her that I think that a lot of the other ones just didn't. They had some tough female characters throughout the Bond series, usually in the later ones. But I always liked her or liked both of them quite a bit because it's such an interesting kind of like love triangle that I think that if you were going to change anything about the movie, you could explore that a little bit more because that would have been one of those interesting things that you could have dove into in the movie rather than trying to figure mm-hmm. out like what High Fat and all of them were doing as far as that goes. Like maybe that love triangle goes a little bit further and you have this more interesting story there.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm with you, Cole. Like Maude Adams as Andrea Anders she was electric every time she was on screen. I mean, even just in the beginning, like she was completely captivating as they're sitting oceanside and he's, you know, he's asking Nick Neck to bring his Tabasco and all that other stuff. But I just thought that they both were incredible. And I really liked Goodnight's character. Initially, when she first came in, I thought she was just going to kind of be a rube, like not very bright, but she ends up being kind of pivotal somewhere towards the end. But she was great, though. I thought she was really good, and obviously she was really into Bond, like everybody. I mean, Moneypenny is throwing herself at Bond, just like every woman does. But in this particular case with Goodnight, it did feel a little bit different. It felt like it's somebody that he could have actually, I don't want to say built something with, but built something with. And so her being, of course,
but she was an agent too, right?
And being
so that's the
yes.
That's the cool kind of unique point of it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought she was really good. Chris, how'd you feel about the leading ladies in general when it comes to the movie?
I thought that they were like great. Like, it was cool to have like this, I don't want to say like this dynamic between the two, because obviously they didn't really interact much, and they were, you know, pretty different characters, but like they still somehow had like a lot of the traditional Bond girl draw to them. You know what I mean? Like, you could buy either of them. Like, if you could, they worked well both being in the movie. Like, as much as we talked about this movie being a mess and having too much going on, I think this is maybe one of the moments where you kind of have, you know, some stuff stacked on top of itself, but it ultimately ends up working well because, like, the people who you've got playing the characters and the material that they're given to work with, it just makes them enjoyable enough to watch, you know? But, like, it almost seemed like they carry just that Bond girl aura so much. Even Goodnight being, you know, an agent herself, that you... Aura. Yeah, they got that aura. I saw Goodnight's aura! it's like, it's almost like if you took one of them out and maybe, you know, replace a lot of the stuff that they were doing with the other, it would still just kind of work because you're like captivated by the characters. Like, you do enjoy seeing them on screen. Like, and again, for, you know, the you know, caveman brain reason, like, they're just both very good women, very good looking women. They're very good women too, you know, they're good people too, I reckon.
Yeah, that Maud Adams, man. Oof.
She sure knew how to get you to keep looking at the screen.
Sure did.
Let me have the Maud Adams paint drying movie.
Who was the leading lady in North by Northwest that we were so smitten
Grace
with?
Grace Kelly? No, Ava Marie Saint. Yeah.
Is that... That's right. Yeah.
Same thing. She has that... They both have very similar... Man, she is.
She's a real Buick.
She is 99 years old, still kicking.
She told me to jump. I'd still ask how high, just in case.
Yeah, seriously. Yep.
She's like, now that you've done that, I found a way to rewind time. I'm like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
I know I did the right thing.
I think Maude Adams actually just died, like, not long ago. No, she's still alive. 78 years old.
Look at her.
Let's go. Let's go, Bond ladies. Let's do it. But it is a very interesting take. I feel like Roger Moore is, and he for a lot of people is a favorite when it does come to Bonds and how he played it and all that. So again, so important pieces when it comes to the Bond movies, several things. All right. So the villain, obviously really important. How Bond is played, obviously really important. Any ancillary pieces, anybody who was also inserted to help Bond. And I know that we've talked about J.W. Pepper, but really so when it comes to, is it Hip, or I also want to make sure I say his name right, but the agent that he had came and helped Bond and picked him up from the Kumite dojo. I don't even know. It's like, Chris, I'm like you. I don't know what was going on there, but
it's cutting in and
he helped was big time help when it came to, and not necessarily, I mean, just as important. The villains are important. Obviously the leading ladies are important, but then having somebody who does jump in to help Bond, and clearly Bond is depicted as somebody who operates solo and doesn't have a partner, but there's always somebody that is very helpful to Bond. In this case, it is Hip, who is out there with his nieces. Whenever he picked up Bond from the dojo and they helped after the Kumite was going on there.
Yeah.
Like, that's awesome. But how cool was Hip, like, you know, having him inserted in different scenes whenever it comes to being able to help Bond out? Cole, how did you like him in relation to helping Bond? Because, you know, more often than not, we don't see Bond get a ton of help, but of course with Daniel Craig's Bond, we've seen him get help from several people, in particular Jeffrey Wright. But how did you like Hip's character in relation to being helpful with Bond?
Yeah, man, I liked him. He was just a, you know, secret agent family man, you know, who just had to deliver his nieces to school while he was on a secret mission, you know. Just
happens.
No, I'm just all joking aside. Like,
right. Taylor's oldest time.
Yeah, we've all been there. I really like that. I gotta that do that shit tomorrow. Like that actor.
He was and his nieces too were so innocuous whenever they first got picked up, and then they end up
fucking
being just
up.
Like Chun Li. Yeah. They were incredible whenever they.
Which that was of the for like, yeah,
it was
I
so
feel
good,
like
dude.
They shoehorn that scene in, Chris, just to have them, you know, like mm-hmm. they needed a reason to have them whoop a bunch of people's asses.
Yeah.
That was so cool. And it was just like, oh, we got these two badasses. We need to figure out how to get them in the movie. And then that's what they came up with, you know, like that's kind of what it felt like to me. I know I'm sure that's not what happened, but yeah.
If that's the reasoning, I'll understand. I'm like, you know what? Fine.
You know what? Cool.
Good scene, actually.
Yep. Now that you mention it.
Oh, dude, no. That scene, I was really close to making that my best scene because they kicked a whole lot of ass, dude. They were awesome. When
they beat him like 30 like people in 8 seconds. Like,
Neil DeBond, he kicked him right in the fucking face.
Yeah,
dude. Like, there's some good. That scene actually, like, as much as it makes zero
that was
sense,
hilarious.
It's actually pretty good. Yeah.
That scene is so funny. It had me cracking up because I was like, this is supposed to be like a traditional that's fight, like toe
to
toe fight, as
there.
Soon as dude bowed.
Not for Bond, he had shit to do.
Yeah.
Martini was getting hot.
You just felt like the Indiana Jones scene where that guy had the sword and he's doing all the fancy moves with the sword and Indiana just shoots him.
Yep.
Oh man, it's so good. But yeah, but listen, like I don't want to rag on it too much. I know the series is bad movies that we love, but it was just it honestly did end up kind of being every time I really was into it, that's whenever it seemed like it would slow down, and I think that was like the tough part about it overall was because it seemed to kill its own momentum. Chris, did you kind of feel like that it was choppy and like I said, I know I said hokey, but it just felt choppy more than anything. Like it didn't really have a certain flow or direction it wanted to go.
Yeah, I agree, and that's what I was saying earlier. You'd get, you know, it would start to get you on the right track. You'd start to learn more about Scaramanga. You start to learn more about the plot, or to see Bond doing some, you know, detective type stuff. That's maybe not the best way to describe it. And then you'd get, you know, 7 or so minutes of something that just feels so different for a Bond movie just in general, but so, like, so just far out of left field for even this one, you know what I mean? It's something that's like still has a way to be involved in the plot and still reveals something or still pushes him in the right direction, but it just feels so aggressively outside of it until it decides mm-hmm. to get right back yep. into yep. it at the last second that it does kind of pull you out of it, you know what I mean? Like you're saying, Keith, like you get that momentum building, you really are starting to feel the story. And then, you know, something just random happens for 7 minutes. And again, you have to kind of remember all the other moving parts and players that are important to the central plot. And then they kind of just all hit you again out of nowhere. And you're like, oh, shit, I forgot that, you know, these are these things I really need to be caring about. This is what this movie is really about. This is what his mission really does entail. So, yeah, it is just a lot of that. And it's like, but I think when it's on the right track, I did enjoy a lot of what it was doing. Like, I know that, you know, there are probably people who are, you know, a bit more down on it than we are. But, like, when it kind of found its footing and it was doing what it needed to do, and it told the story in a way that was, you know, just the most cohesive. You know, not every story needs to be straight point A to point B with nothing in between. Like, it's fine to have some mm-hmm. stuff in between to just add some variety to the film. But when it was kind of on that point A to point B thing, like, it just gave us a lot of great moments. You got to get a lot of good Christopher Lee stuff. Mm-hmm. And, again, that is also what kind of made it upsetting, that you had so much of this stuff in the middle that it did kind of...
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm sure Christopher Lee is in it more than I'm giving right. him credit yes. for. But in the whole, like, yes. 2 hours and 5 minutes, I feel like if you told me he's only in it for 15 minutes, I'd be like... Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah, it's like, yeah, there's,
you know, that weird thing we talk about, like, where, you know, it works particularly well to have Godzilla be in the movie for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Like, this is the opposite. Like, Scaramanga, we needed more, right? Like, we just needed more Scaramanga.
He's and, the, like, anti-Godzilla?
It's, yeah, we need it. Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
You're right.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, that's the perfect way to describe it, though, Cole. That's it.
Because, and we, before we get too into, like, the categories, but, like, the ending scene of this, the gunfight between him and Bond, is one of the better, like, scenes in all of Bond movies. Like, it just is so, it feels so good, and it feels like the stakes are so high. And it's just really cool to see Bond outsmart somebody rather than just brutalize them or, you know, use gadgets or whatever it is. Like, he just climbed down some scaffolding dressed up as himself and tricked Francisco Scaramanga. And, like, that scene is tense. You know what I mean? Like, you don't get a lot of those in Bond movies where you just have that intensity. And in the opening scene also, when he kills the first guy that comes, also amazing scene. It's like, with those things in a movie, like, how do you make the rest of the movie not be good? It's so curious, like, to figure out how.
No, agreed. Yep.
But, yeah, it's just convoluted, right? And I love it because of, in spite of those things. And this is one of those movies that I can pretty much watch at any time just because I enjoy the highs so much that it makes up for all the lows to me. And I definitely could understand why that wouldn't necessarily be the case for everybody.
But. Well, and I think just like we're talking about, like Andrew talked about ad nauseum, Scaramanga is the glue to that, right? Like where he holds it, he's the adhesive. And it's kind of weird to talk about it when it comes to a Bond movie because Bond's supposed to be that. But I feel like that's the case because this is a villain that man, I could really get into. Honestly, this guy, he just, when it comes to a Bond villain, I have to be afraid of this guy. I have to feel like Bond maybe doesn't have a chance. And I legitimately, having watched this for the first time, when I'm watching, I was nervous for James. Obviously, I knew he was going to get killed, but I was just like, you know, how is he going to get out of this? And he was in the House of Horrors at the end, just like you're talking about, the assassin was too. And so it's like, how is Bond going to out-trick this guy and on his own turf too? Because that was the biggest thing. Is like, it wasn't a place where Bond was you know, had the upper hand or something like that. Like, he had to do this thing. So it was, that's why I like, yeah, Scaramanga, like we talked about. He was incredible as Christopher Lee was incredible as Scaramanga, and I thought that he was just a great villain. I thought just a good premise. He had the golden gun, he had the specialty made bullets, he only needed the one shot, like all the things that a good villain, you know, because it's like, of course a good villain could take out a bunch of people if he has an automatic weapon or something like this, but if it comes to a guy that has, he only needs is one shot, all he, you know, he has these specific bullets.
And he uses a gun that he has to build out of cigarette lighters and pens. You know what I mean? Like, that's just, what a badass. Like, he hinders himself. He makes himself have one bullet for no
reason. Right.
Right.
He's like, well, I need it to be tough, so what I'm going to do is this.
Just a goofy fellow.
That's how you know a guy is a badass whenever, like you said, Cole, whenever he's making it difficult for himself.
Right.
He's a, his own,
like,
handicap.
LeBron decided to play with two left-footed shoes, you know?
Yeah.
Guy said, I need a challenge.
Like, I'm gonna make
James
it easy
Bond
on everybody.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
That's funny to hear him, like, to think about that. He's just sitting at his desk. He's like, you know, I think I got this. Bring me James Bond.
Fuck, I don't have anything to do
right
next Saturday.
Yeah, he's like, I'm ready.
Bring me James Bond. It's like, what?
Yeah, mail Bond this bullet. I'm ready.
Yeah.
I'm supposed to go golfing, but it's going to rain. I need something else to do. Oh, fuck. I guess I'll just,
yeah,
see when I can bring me James
fight
Bond.
With a super spy.
Yeah, with James.
See how I make out.
Oh, shit, the 12 o'clock showing sold out.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's like, I might as well. So,
I'll get up and make brunch next, the next morning. It's like, okay.
I guess a gunfight.
Yeah.
They had a gunfight, like, after that.
Somebody had to go, man.
Yeah, somebody had to go.
He was going
to
make some pancakes.
That's
in the morning.
Make British people sit at the table for too long. Yeah, that kind of combined, like, three Charlie Murphy things, like, he took me in the house, and he served me pancakes.
Served me pancakes.
Pancakes.
Does that line suck?
He
had a straight face with it. He served me pancakes, and he just stood there and stared at the camera.
And Keith, I go back and I watch him, and like when you, like, there are just certain ways that he says things that you're like, he's not making this shit up. Like, that's one that I'm like, that story is true. Like, the way he just, like,
true,
reiterates pancakes, it's like he's being dead serious. He's
it
not joking.
1,000% happened. It 1,000% happened. There is no doubt in my mind.
Like, if he didn't say it with a straighter face and he didn't do that double down, I'm like, all right, he's being silly. But he's like, what happened to that? He took us in the house and he served us pancakes.
Like he said when he's telling the story.
He's like, fuck, that happens.
At the end of it, he says, and this will be a line I'll say until I'm blue in the face. He said, there's a lot of great storytellers out there. He said, who the fuck can make up some shit like that? And that is exactly that is the exact line. I know that's right. That is absolutely right. Who can make up something like that? Nobody can. It has to be a true story, and that's why that line encapsulates
Scare
all
Mangles
things.
Scare Mangles in hell, going challenge him.
He perfectly. All right, and make sure your people is there. Make sure Knick Knack is there to see him. Because you might get embarrassed.
Because you might get embarrassed.
I will say, there is a lot of oddities to this movie. The person, the part, and the person that I just don't understand anything about was the fake Reggie Jackson character at the end that Goodnight kicked into, like, the liquid nitrogen or whatever the hell. What was that guy doing? Yeah, he had zero lines, and then he got kicked into the... What was he doing in the movie?
The solar plant, that was the guy who didn't say
the
nothing.
Solar panels.
Like running like the world's largest solar energy provider by himself. just doing
sleeveless.
His thing. Yep.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. That guy is hilarious.
It's the only way to work in that industry. Can't wear sleeves in that industry.
Yeah. No, not in that industry. Absolutely not.
That was a funny guy.
Anyway, fake Reggie Jackson cracked me up because he just, like, he didn't have any line. He just pointing at Goodnight, and then she got the jump on him, and he fell into the liquid, whatever. Anyway.
Tough way to go.
Yeah, so it is a tough way to go, especially sleeveless, because he was like, shit, I should have worn those sleeves. I maybe would have lasted longer.
I'd have been less cold.
Is this your of the Roger Moore series, Cole? Where does this? I know he had seven. Is this one of your? Because this is a movie that you love. So this one of your favorite Roger Moores?
Man, that's hard to say. I think it's probably. It might be, a fifth or sixth, maybe seventh. Not seventh. View to a Kill is seventh. That one's pretty bad. Even though it's got Christopher Walken in it. This one, I definitely like. I like The Spy Who Loved Me more. I like For Your Eyes Only more, Live and Let Die more, Moonraker more. And then this and Octopussy are pretty close. And then View to a Kill, I guess,
Correct.
Would be the last one. So it's not my favorite. Like, it's definitely not one of my favorites of the Bond movies. I just love all the Bond movies, even the bad ones. And this one is one of those that I think it's one of those that tried something different and it didn't necessarily play out the way they thought it would, but it's got great stuff in it. Like, some of the other ones are bad and they're just bad. Like, they're, you know, the only thing I can say about them is that they're Bond movies and I like Bond movies. But, like, this is not one of those. I think there's a lot of good stuff in
it. I would say it checks off a lot of the boxes that you need. And while there is some fluff and some fat, overall, I think it still does it, right? And so, obviously, I mean, you pick your movie and this is what it was. But it still also did a lot of good things that you like to do. And like I said, I liked that the action scenes when it did. What was interesting, I mean, the action was really good. The car chase right after they left the Kumite Dojo was incredible. It's interesting that this movie was rated PG.
Yep.
The movie's rated PG. I know there wasn't a ton of, like, gore. I mean, we got some headshots and we got some sexual, some innuendo stuff, but this movie was rated PG.
Yeah, for sure. Ratings used to be weird, man. Like, you could just about see Maude Adams' boobs in this movie. Like, and it was PG.
Yeah, it's wild, crazy. Dude. I don't know, man. It's just, I mean, like I said, the ratings were, it was different. And I think, I mean, obviously now it'd be like a PG-13. I don't think it would get into the R category. There was some language, but there, of course, there weren't any F-bombs. But still, it was good, though. It wasn't overly... That would be really the one headshot. Oh, do we get two headshots? I know we got the assassin at the beginning that Scaramanga killed. Was that a headshot? I can't remember. And then the solar expert, he got a headshot, but we just saw the bullet.
Yeah, it was. Yep. That was kind of all Scaramanga did was headshots. Yeah, so
yeah, probably that was good.
Yeah.
Shame you're so evil.
Yeah. All right, so we can move on into the categories that I actually have. So I had a tough time. I just end up having multiple people in several categories. So I'll go ahead and apologize in advance. But we'll get into the laugh out loud. There was several, and I know we've already talked about it, the one-liners that Roger Moore was able to deliver in these that were hilarious. So I had two. There are several, but I had two. One, whenever he's talking to Anders at the beginning, and he's like, so if I were to see Scaramanga, how would I know it's him? And she's like, he's tall, slim, and dark. He goes, so is my aunt.
So is my aunt. Yeah.
That was hilarious. But then the Bond in the, I keep saying the Kumite fight pit, but in the fight pit, whenever the guy bowed to him and he just kicks him right in the face and it's like, dude, no, that's a cheap shot. That made me laugh really hard because he just took the guy out right, like instantly. So those were my two laugh out louds. There were several. So Chris, you know, the one you mentioned earlier was hilarious when she's like, I lost my charm. And he's like, not from where I'm standing.
And then he had to go to the pharmacy because he had swallowed that bullet and he was trying to shit amazing. It out, dude. That's quality, too.
Yeah, head of the pharmacy. It is. All right, Cole, what had you laughing?
Man, it's always the same scene for me. It's the first scene where Bond meets with M and they're talking about Scaramanga. And he just asks him, like, M's like, do you know anything about him? And Bond just unloads, like a full data file on Scaramanga, like his whole life and stuff. And he goes, and I think that's it. But he said, and then after that, he goes, but who would pay $1 million to have me dead? And M says, jealous husbands, outraged chef, and humiliated tailors.
Humiliated was hilarious.
Yep. So that's for me. That was, again, one of those, like, the first three scenes of this where it was just like, oh, yeah, this shit is going to be unbelievable.
Yeah, that was really funny. The humiliated tailors one did get me, too. That was funny. All right, Chris, what had you laughing?
Oh, man, I had a couple, too. But one is, it's when he's in there with the dancer and he's, you know, kissing his stomach because, like, you really do have a magnificent abdomen. And, like, right as he says it, the fucking guy, like, slams his hands on his shoulders and just pulls them off. And they just have that huge fight. It's almost like slapstick humor. Like, the way that the guy grabs him is so fucking funny. So there's that one. Really, the other one is when, you know, when Bond and that other guy are bowing about to spar and Bond just fucking kicks the shit out of him, immediately knocks him out, dude. Like, the sound effect and, like, the way that he falls over, it's just like, oh, he might have just killed him, actually. That might even be a KO. He might just be dead.
Seriously.
Yeah, like, I think he just killed
him. Yeah, it was 1974, too, though, so, yeah.
Hit him with the front kick. Pow!
Pow! Ah!
Better than that with the little kids.
Do the asshole eyeball.
Show the move, bro.
Old, grutty.
Archie
needs
a little too old.
Sorry, Chris.
All right. So, another category I had multiples in. Yeah, I'm sorry, but another category I had multiples. Mr. Mustang, I had two, I guess technically three people. So, one was Hip. It was actually his nieces. Whenever they came in and kicked everybody's ass at Kumite, I was very impressed by that because they kicked a whole lot of ass in a little bit of time. So that was they were great. But also Clifton James as J.W. Pepper, I thought that, you know, when he came in, he absolutely cooked, man. Like, he came in throwing 1,000 miles an hour. It was just like Mike Miller off the bench.
He was
just
going for
and
it,
shooting
man.
A bunch of threes and just 100% going for it. So those are my Mustangs. Cole, who'd you have?
I went with Maude Adams, man. She was fucking fantastic in this and just, like, timeless. Like, just her in general, like, her beauty, but also her acting and just, like, everything about Maude Adams in this was just fucking fantastic. So I got to go with her.
Yeah. Yeah. Can't beat that. Chris, who'd you have as Mustang?
Oh, man, I had to go with Clifton James. What just an insane character to be in this movie. I don't know. I guess he wasn't – I don't want to say how much because it was a Mr. Mustang performance. He wasn't in a whole lot. But, like, he's in it enough for you to just have a moment where you do have to step back and go, what the fuck are we doing? But it's so funny. Like, everything he says and does is, like, when he's on screen, you can't help but to, like, just be, like – waiting for him to open his mouth and say something again. I hope it's like the most racist thing you've ever heard. Because if it's not, it's going to be fucking hilarious. It's going to be funny.
It's either really racist or really funny.
Or it's hilarious. And it's like you said, Cole, he really does just like go for like, it is just such a ginormous swing at this kind of person and just kind of going for this. And again, I enjoyed
seeing
him.
We're Democrats, Maybell. She wanted to buy that elephant.
He said, "You come down and do that, my boy. You boy, yeah. I'd haul your
those
ass."
Democrats.
And I'm like, "What are you talking about? What the fuck is this guy talking about, man? He's so funny. He's shit talking an elephant, and then it pushes him in the ocean.
Yeah.
Not the ocean, but in the river, or whatever. Yep. Who shit talks an elephant? First of all,
yeah. Oh shit.
Just a goofy guy." He pulls out his wallet and tries to show off his badge. Fucking, yeah, 30,000. It's hanging off the ground and shit.
That's my jurisdiction. He just goes out there and they just arrest him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, call my wife.
That's some true American stuff right there. Talking about his jurisdiction in like Macau and he's from Louisiana.
Yeah. He opened his wallet, the Oppenheimer film reel fucking rolled out.
Right.
All 11 miles of it.
Yeah. 11 miles of it, yeah.
Yeah. Some of it's still in this hotel room and shit. It's just dragging. Easiest man on earth to, you know, follow.
Yeah,
I heard in the outtakes he said, "I don't want to hear any of that jurisdiction crap." Diesel, I went with Scaramanga. Scaramanga, I thought that he, like, just like we're talking about, he his ego and his hubris gets in the way, and he's all of a sudden wants to take on the greatest super spy of all time just because he killed some random people on his island. It's like, dude, no, maybe have a couple of get a couple of cupcakes on your schedule first before you just jump into playing Alabama. I don't think that he really thought right. That one through. So ultimately, is Scaramanga, even though he was incredible the entire movie. So that was my Diesel, was him. Cole, who'd you have?
It's Scaramanga, and on top of everything you've said so far, Keith, is being 100% true. Also, like, if you're gonna be a master assassin, don't make sure that the bullet you kill somebody with is you're the only person that can afford those. Like, that's just bad. It was like the water bandits in Home Alone, you know? Like, once you do get caught,
the wet bandits,
gonna,
yeah,
they're
seriously,
gonna pin
yeah.
everything to you.
Yeah.
100%.
It's again the dangers of thinking you're that guy and just not being that guy, you know?
Just not being that guy. He was smoking Pineapple Express, just leaving all over the city.
Yeah.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt about it.
Piss run down his leg.
All right, Chris, who's your Diesel?
Man, it's the same person. It's Scaramanga. This is maybe like the most in the spirit of the Jameis Winston Award is what it started off as, like, as we've ever seen. Like, this is no joke, almost the exact same thing as, you know, Jameis from Dune. It's like, it's got a couple of differences, but it's this guy who just has this immense confidence and this hubris who's just like, yeah, I'm just going to wrap it up and I'm going to kill you real quick. Like, this is just something that I, you know, despite the fact that I should just move on and do literally anything else, this is what I really want to get into right now. And he just dies from it. You know what I mean? Like, the plan was, like I was joking, he's just sitting around. He's like, bring me James Bond. Let me see if I can smoke him
right
next.
Now.
Yeah. Bored as hell this weekend. Everyone's busy.
Like,
fucking Charles
sauce.
Is going to play golf. Yeah. Richard's hanging out with his wife and shit again. Where's James Bond at, I guess?
Yeah. Rich people.
Very wacky rich plan. People. Hey, man, yeah. You want to play, like, you know, fucking polo or something like that?
All right, rent to do. Gonna go with Christopher Lee. We talked about him half the pod. It's Scaramanga. We've already talked about the myriad of reasons why we loved him and he was great. But yeah, so I'm not gonna go back into it. But That was my rinse dude, Christopher Lee, Scaramanga. Cole, who'd you have?
Christopher Lee is Scaramanga, of course. Like, not only was he a great Bond villain, you actually believed that this character was truly psychotic, right? Like, he had those things. Yep. Like, when he met with Bond and he was like, I just admire you and all that sort of stuff, it's just like, man, this dude is truly fucking crazy. And Christopher Lee just kind of, you know, I feel like was let down by the movie, and it is a bummer because he was so good in this.
Yeah, he crushed. He really was good. Chris, who'd you have?
Cole, you brought up a great point when you said, like, he's just truly psychotic in these, like, less bombastic ways. Like, he didn't get him on the island and then start, like, yelling and spitting, like, I finally got you here to kill you. Like, he almost had this, like, weird sense of, like, hospitality and dinner, just saying, like, I do admire you. Yeah, they had dinner.
Showed up with a bottle of Dom. Like, just pure and it's lunatic. Just like,
yeah, like, that's just, like, a cocky, crazy, you know, kind of guy who, you know, ultimately probably believed that things were going to go differently for him that weekend. Like I said, he thought he was going to get up that Sunday and just make, like, a casual brunch. Like, that didn't just happen. It's like, no, sir, buddy. But, you know, Chris really just does, like, a great job, like, that character for his little screen time. He probably has more time than I'm giving him credit for. I guess, like, I would have loved to have seen him more. But for him to have been, you know, maybe overshadowed with the time that some other people got, he did just leave a very lasting impact on you. Did really buy him as a person who, you know, maybe isn't, you know, spinning around in the chair, you know, in the sharp suit, cackling supervillain. But it's like, this is an evil person. This is a villain. This is someone that who Bond is going to have to deal with one way or another. And he just brings a different take on that kind of, you know, that kind of evil. And it just kind of personifies in a different way. And, like, he really did sell you on, like, the super cocky, I really think I'm going to pull this off thing. And that's kind of tough, right? Like, that's already, like, a tough character to kind of drop to. But to be able to sell that across from James Bond, a person you can genuinely think, like, oh, you know, of course we know it's the movie. We know that Bond's going to win. But, you know, he just kind of has this presence that makes you think maybe he will get him. You know, maybe this will be harder for Bond than we think it.
But he also, like, so yeah, he was just like, I'm going to, yeah, go ahead and still schedule that brunch that we have for Sunday. He's like, no, bro, you're not going to be here. What are you talking about? Dad, you still want those reservations that?
Yeah.
Cancel them shit.
Yeah, cancel that. Give that table to somebody else.
Yeah, it's not happening.
It's family of four that might want that table. Go ahead and cough that up, buddy.
All right, so for best scene, I talked about it, but the car chase after Goodnight was kidnapped by Scaramanga and Nick Knack, that car chase, man, it was pretty awesome. I'm not going to lie to you. Like, I wasn't expecting that, especially for a movie made in 74. I just thought it was really well-paced. It was well-timed. Yeah, no, it was sick. Yeah, it was sick. I love that. That was dope. Cole, what'd you have for best scene?
Man, for me, it's the ending shootout, like, the just head-to-head. Those guys had kind of been, like, in a lot of ways, it was paced like a vintage boxing match where they just kind of danced around each other for a while, kind of talked shit a little bit, and then finally had their showdown. And that showdown was just cool. Like, the, you know, it was a little bit gimmicky with some of the stuff in the fun house, but I feel like that is something that you kind of need for these two guys to, like, actually have a fight, because, of course, like, in a modern Bond movie, it would have been, like, a crazy long-term shootout, things, all these different things happen, or a fist fight or whatever, but that wasn't the way they made movies back then, and I just really love that scene. I think that it makes up for a lot of sins.
Oh, 100%. Absolutely did. Chris, what'd you have? Best scene?
I went with the dinner scene right before the shootout. You know, I'm always going to be one to pick, like, a weird thing that's just a conversation of people before something super exciting and very well done. Like you said, Cole, like, in the gunfight, I know I'm the weird one for taking this. But, like, like I said, we just missed so much of them interacting and really getting this, like, sense of, I don't want to say animosity, or this sense of, like, Bond seeing him as a rival, because that's maybe not it, but, like, we missed out on a lot of stuff that kind of sells you as this person that Bond needs to kill or wants to kill for a reason other than his boss said, hey, will you go, you know, shoot this guy in the head and then, like, come back home? Like, that conversation starts off as him being, you know, still having that level of hospitality, and then he starts to try to sell Bond and him as being kind of the same because they enjoy killing people. And, you know, so it's like that's a good moment to kind of have to sell on. Rivalry is not the right word. I'm blanking on the word that I should be using here, but to just kind of sell you on, like, the tension that these two are going to have, you know, before this fight, because there are tons of villains, you know, that Bond just kind of gets his assignment on. He goes and he finds and they have, like, half a conversation, and Bond's right. like, okay, well, you've got the blow-up Jupiter ray, so I got to kill you now, and, you know, that's fine. You know what I mean? Like, that's fine, but this guy isn't, like we said, he isn't so dastardly with these crazy plans that you can just kind of fill in the gaps on Bond's additional motivation to kill him. Like, you have this good conversation between these guys.
He steps up the line.
He is habitual.
You know, he becomes a habitual line stepper, right? And he kind of pushes Bond to be like, oh, yeah, I'm going to kill you. Habitually. So I did really like that scene. Like I said, it filled in a lot of what I felt we were missing between, like, some of the interactions between these guys, and just, you know, it's not necessarily the same thing as the scene in Skyfall when I have no idea why I'm blanking on his name. He's got him, like, locked in the box, and he's, you know, talking to Bond, he's talking to M. You know, that adds some additional evilness to him. It's not necessarily that kind of scene. It's still one of those that you just, it's like a great moment between the characters to get you to this point to really buy into. You know, Bond's going to go out of his way to make sure he kills this guy, not just because it's his mission, but because it's just like there's something between them now. Yeah. And again, like, you need that when it's not like, you know, I have the Oppenheimer bomb, like, in my pickup truck that I'm going to drop.
Absolutely.
Like, you need something like that to really get you on board with smoking a guy.
All evil, pure evil. He wanted all the things. Just take your golden gun, man, and be good. All right, Cole, did you find anything on the award side?
No, sir. No awards on this one. You know, usually Bond movies later on or earlier on have, like, best sound, that sort of stuff, but it didn't get anything.
All right, trivia-wise, I did sprinkle mine in earlier. I said that, you know, it's the lowest grossing Bond film, then it almost, coupled with some behind-the-scene problems, nearly made this the last James Bond movie. Thankfully, the problems were worked through, and it was not. So we still have a great series of movies going on. Did you guys find anything?
Not too much for me. Main thing is I've always wanted, for probably about 3 years now, I've always wanted this to be remade based more on the book with Henry Cavill as Bond and Daniel Kaluuya as Scaramanga.
Oh.
And that's always been the movie that I'm
that
like.
Is a pitch.
Set it in the 1960s. Not a modern day, and just let those guys just fucking do it. That's always been my dream for The Man with the Golden Gun, because I do think that the story is good, and I think Scaramanga is good, and I think it could be a fantastic movie. So
I can see it. No,
yeah, that's awesome. I'm in.
Right, when those two dudes just be fucking dope,
like Danny Kaluuya pulling off that, like, level of, like, cockiness and almost like shit talking, like he would do the, like, signature Kaluuya,
so,
like, cackle while he's doing it. Some of the face he would make. Yeah, no, you're cooking.
Yep, he'd be so good. Be so good at Scaramanga.
Second week in a row we've casted Daniel Kaluuya in something, by the way. But again,
yeah,
you can put him in anything.
Every week, just about.
Put him in anything. He can do it all.
Next week, I'm sure he'll be good too.
Blue Streak was so funny, dude. We were like, yeah.
It's not
Daniel Kaluuya's the only person who can do
this. He's amazing in everything. Because
he can do anything.
That dude played Fred Hampton when we got him in.
You got him saying he's got a cat in his pants at the end.
Yeah. Sure do. We don't make the rules, man.
Absolutely. We don't read the script. Script read me. Find The Man with the Golden Gun, 1974. That is going to be on Max. So everybody go check it out. But we are back to my pick. And we're actually going to stay on Max because it has a... There's a lot of good movies going on right now with
it's
Max.
A double impact.
We're still... So we're wrapping up or just about to wrap up the... nah, man, I should have, yeah. But it's not. But we are going to go with, this, continue with the series, bad movies that we love. We're going to go to 2018.
2018, damn. Okay.
Little Jodie Foster. We've got Jodie Foster. We've got Brian Tyree Henry. We've got a little bit Jeff Goldblum. We've got all kinds of good people. So we're going to go Hotel Artemis.
What is it? I missed.
Find that on Max. Hotel Artemis. Cool. Yeah.
All right.
Yes, sir. So we can go find that on Max. Let's go. Sterling K. Brown. We got a whole host of people.
I meant to watch this one.
People
just
keep showing up. Batista, all the folks.
Yeah, this is like a lot of people in it. I always meant to get around to this. I think some people I know actually watched it like today. Someone asked somebody else for a movie rec. They watched this and Bad Times at the El Royale. So very. I don't know why. I don't know. Like,
These ones
grouped together in my head too. I don't even think they came out too close to each other. But every time I think about one, I do think about the other. Very strange. Mm-hmm.
I don't remember this movie being bad. Was it bad?
Yeah, it didn't. Yeah, Rotten Tomatoes didn't love it.
Okay. All right. Good enough. That works for me.
Yeah, right.
I just remember
liking
it.
And that's what I'm saying. Bad movie. Yeah, so.
Yeah.
I like that. That's what I'm saying. And that's why we're here right now. That's why we're in this position. We'll talk about it, though. But, yeah, so stay on Max. Go to Max. Man with the Golden Gun, stay on Max, Hotel Artemis. But for all of us here at the stream team, Keith Evans, Camilla, Chris Lowry, tall, slim, and dark, so is my aunt.